Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, March 26th, a live remote panel was held and Joe was joined by attorney, politician, and former U.S. Representative for New York's 19th Congressional District, John Faso, former Biden administration official Anna Markowitz, investment banker on Wall Street Mark Whitman, best-selling author, journalist, professor of English at Vassar College Amitava Kumar, best-selling author and the co-founder of Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, Elizabeth Lesser, the author of three novels and a freelance journalist who has reported about life in Darfur, northern Uganda, and eastern Congo, Dina Mengestu, best-selling author, memoirist, essayist, and critic, Francine Prose, and an iconic writer whose latest book is a memoir about self-reflection and a vibrant exploration of the modern dynamics of gender and identity, Lucy Sont.
What the hell's going on? I'm interested in the thoughts that you have in a day-to-day. All of you have professional lives. All of you work very hard in various pursuits. And I'm wondering, so you look at, let's just take a story from today about the text leak, which of course was from earlier this week, but is obviously still quite relevant. But without talking about that specifically, I'm curious, and Amitava will begin with you. I'm just curious as to like how you kind of process all that and figure out, you know, where we are in this moment. In your piece in The New Yorker, you had just come from India. You write about this amazing trip, and does I assume you can't help but compare.
Yeah, all over the world, the rise of quote-unquote strong men and the interest amidst all this chaos, the interest in trying to find someone who will be strong, who will make cuts, who will clean up the system, that's a very strong seduction, and somehow people fall into the trap of thinking that such wild remedies are possible. You know, I was on this train in India going from Kashmir to Kanyakumari. I wanted to ask people questions about what has changed in our country? Where are we now compared to 20 years ago? What are your interests? Just so that I could, by talking to people, find the temperature of the country in some ways. And I think what is happening in the last few weeks in this country, if you're on Facebook as much as I am, you'll notice that there have been lots of town hall meetings. There is a great interest in all kinds of communities to collect and talk about what is happening here, you know? So there is a curiosity, I suppose. There's a desire to make sense of where are we going? What are the decisions we are making? What do we need to do? How can people come together and maybe perhaps in some countries or in some situations have dialogue? I think, in America, we are lucky to be able to meet like this and have dialogues. In many countries, people with differences would not even be sitting in the same room. You know what I'm saying? And so that's my first observation about my own desire to be on a train and then be here having a public conversation where questions are being thrown. Joe in his genial way presiding over a general town hall meeting, you know? And people, I'm sure, will come up with differences. It's a wonderful thing to be able to have a dialogue.
So, Dina, how do we protect that?
I think we've actually already lost it. I think it's great, the idea that we're all here having a conversation, but I think we also lose sight of the number of people who can't be here and aren't able to be here because they're already under increasing pressure and threat. So I think our ability to talk honestly has already collapsed because we don't have the capacity to have all the people in the room who should be a part of those conversations. If your status in the U.S. is even slightly vulnerable right now, the idea that you would come out publicly and speak about what you're facing and what your family might be facing, that's not, you know, maybe a small number of people are willing to take that risk, but I think many people aren't, and for very good reason. So I think we're already at the state where we've lost a lot. I think until we begin to recognize that we have already lost a lot and that what we are trying to do is make sure we don't lose more, we can't begin to claw our way out of this problem. So, right now I feel like the damage is already really profound. And the idea that these restrictions on our speech, you know, they've centered on so many different kind of critical issues, but obviously it's about kind of controlling what all of us feel like we can say. And as soon as you begin to take people out of the conversation, you begin to take people out of the room, the level of our discourse is already diminished, and the complexity of what we can understand and what we can say is already gone. So I think we have to be much angrier. I think we have to be much more vocal about the conversations that we're not having, and we need to try to imagine who's not in these, all the people who aren't in these spaces with us right now.
So I think of you, Lucy. You transitioned at the age of 66, and now are in this moment. And I can't imagine what that. Obviously, there is the, which you write about beautifully in your book, which we can talk about a little bit later, but the actual decision and the transition, but then the world at large and how trans people are seen.
Yeah, well, you know, the has seemed like a trans moment, which maybe has gone on for as long as 10, 15, 20 years now. And that's through a whole bunch of cultural signs happening that people felt emboldened, especially the younger generation. And somehow, I almost feel like it wasn't in my conscious control at all, responded finally to stuff I'd been sitting on my entire life. Since single digits, I was suddenly freed to move forward. It was made possible by traditional kinship structures breaking down around the globe. And this fascism we're facing is a direct response to that. It's almost like the two halves of an egg, the matter and antimatter, two halves of an egg. It was never a comfortable situation for trans people and never has been at any point in life, but except that, you know, a lot of it flew under the radar because people weren't looking for it. Now, suddenly, there's this, you know, pseudo-religious objections to it. And then, you know, bingo, the president of the United States declares that we do not exist. I'm sure he doesn't care, Trump, but he's pressured by the religious right. And the right wing, in general, wants to make things simpler. And when something as clear-cut as the, you know, A, B, you know, one gender, the other gender, when that dichotomy gets fractured, there are more things appearing in between those poles or outside of them, then, you know, suddenly a lot of people can't compute anymore. And, of course, we are a threat to male supremacy, because once you declare that there are areas between the genders, then that really deprives men from saying we are men and we can do this and women can't do that. So, you know, so much of what's going on in Washington is goofy retrograde action, trying to drag the train back to the yards with chains. It may work through terror, but ultimately it'll fail, as all such things have.
I do want to ask you a follow-up, which is that you've made this point that you do look at it because you're older and you've gone through this experience that you do look at a lot of it from afar.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
There is such a thing or things as trans communities, Brooklyn, various places among the young, college campuses. Look, I'm 40. The few times I've ever been to a trans function, I've been 40 years older than anybody in the room. And my experiences are very different. They're also much more nuanced, you know, because I've seen a lot of life, seen a lot of exceptions, can't quite hold to an ideology about it. And also, frankly, I live right across the river here and don't leave my house ever, except when I'm going public. I sort of have two modes, very private or very public and nothing in between. Yeah, I'm watching this with obviously alarm and consternation and I'm not so afraid for myself, but for my younger people, I'm terrified for them.
Mark Whitman, one of the questions that we get asked so often on the panel is, what can we do about the current situation? And that's from people from both sides, quite frankly. But I'm interested in your thoughts on that as to when we look at where we are now of processing what we process and being able to try to move forward in a positive direction.
That's a great... Joe, thanks for the easy question.
Yeah, solve that, Mark, and get back to me, okay?
In my preparation for today, after I got out of the corner and stopped sobbing that I would be on such an august panel, I actually noticed that there's a real commonality here in that most of these folks here deal with identities that have been forged by journeys, either geographical or intensely personal. There is a middle of this country, if you will, that we lost clearly in the last election. Folks that, by my diagnosis, believe that they were under threat economically and perhaps even socially by the left. So actually, Joe, the question I have for everyone here, since personal identity is such a key focus, is we've got to figure out, frankly, how to appeal to those folks that got duped and help them better understand why their interests align with what we historically consider a liberal democracy. And to me, I guess the framing of the question more than a solution, but at least it's a first step towards that solution. And I do think the group we have assembled today could offer meaningful insight.
John Fasso, while you may take umbrage at the word duped, but there's still, and I know this about you, very much a want for people to be able to get together and find common ground.
Absolutely, and this is a great forum to do that, and your radio audience also affords us a great opportunity to communicate. I think one of the big problems we face in our country is that people tend to self-segregate themselves and get into groupthink and bubbles. They listen, read, and watch things that they already agree with. So it becomes a self-confirming cycle. And it's very often that you find...
Because reading anything else just drives you nuts.
Well, you know, I think there actually are a lot of sources, but you have to work to find them sometimes. And I think also... I occasionally am in Washington. I was there the last couple of days and over the weekend, in fact. And you find that so many of the folks that get the attention are people who are, show horses. They're not workhorses. They're interested in getting on cable TV, whether it's Fox or MSNBC or CNN, whatever it is. And they want to appeal to the more extreme nature. And you see this in terms of the social media and the internet. You know, politicians have to, in the House of Representatives, for instance, you got to run for office every 2 years. And if you're in a swing district like I was, that means you have to raise a lot of money. And you have to spend a lot of time doing that. And what you see so often with these folks who are on both extremes, that they're using these messages in order to help them attract attention, which helps them raise money. And they're not so much focused on the people in D.C., and they're good Democrats and good Republicans on both sides, and there are also some horrific people on both sides. And the ones that are out there constantly trying to get attention in the media, they are, frankly, they're not workhorses. They're not there doing the day-to-day stuff. What I get frustrated about as well is that we are faced with an extreme crisis in terms of the West, the democracies, and I include in that South Korea and Japan and Australia, et cetera. But we have an existential threat from those on the other side, and I mean Xi Jinping and Putin and the Iranians, who believe that their system is better, that the top-down autocratic system is better. The comment before of our fellow panelists about strongmen. Well, we know we have some real strongmen in Xi Jinping and Putin and others, and they're saying to the rest of the world, particularly the developing world, you know, those democracies, they're a mess. Look at the kind of controversies they have and back and forth. That's not the system that works. And I fundamentally believe that this system does work. I'm confident in the future. We have bumps in the road. We've always had them in our history. And this is a time where I hear people say, oh, we're in a constitutional crisis. Oh, it's never been so bad. Well, how about the Civil War? How about Pearl Harbor? You know, this country, how about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and their adherents going at each other, hammer and tong, calling each other all sorts of insufferable things? I think it's important for us to have context that where we are today, what is manifested, how Donald Trump was able to win and the movement that he leads is something that was long developing. I have confidence in our system and in the stability of the system, and I do think that ultimately the checks and balances always seem to be able to get us through whatever we're in at the moment. And this is a moment where it's deeply controversial. But I think oftentimes Americans, we are losing sight of our common bond in terms of the system that we have over almost 250 years. When we have an existential threat, we're seeing from Xi Jinping, from Putin, and their like, because they believe our system doesn't work. And I think that's the fundamental thing that, frankly, most of the people in this room are in the same demographic I am. It's our kids and our grandchildren that are really going to have to face this issue.
So with that said, Francine Prose, you wrote in The Guardian on the night that Donald Trump won re-election, I look the way people do outside the intensive care unit as they wait to learn whether a friend will survive. Our friend in this case is democracy. That is, that's not as rosy a picture as John painted.
No, I don't feel that it's rosy. But in fact, when I think about all my anxieties before the election, they just seem like a joke now. I mean, I really didn't have the imagination to predict what's happening now, although I have a fabulous imagination for disaster. This was beyond that. So I do think we're in an extreme situation and an unprecedented situation. I mean, twice at Bard and once in the Eastern Correctional Facility, I taught classes in totalitarianism and literature. And perhaps I know too much about it or have read too much about it or thought too much about it, but the steps by which a democratic society or a reasonably equitable society moves towards totalitarianism and fascism are very familiar, and there's a pattern, and I can see that pattern happening now. At the same time, we all live in this kind of schizoid moment, knowing that people from our own communities who are undocumented are getting deported. And the idea that, when I was coming up in the 60s, you could have demonstrations and you could, I know someone who climbed the walls of the Pentagon. If that happened today, that person would be on the first flight to El Salvador. So the things that are happening now have never happened before. But at this moment, the peculiar thing about our lives is that one part of our brain knows that this is happening, and another part of our brain says, oh, that email from 2 days ago that I forgot to answer, from a student, whatever. So we're just, I think we're toggling back and forth between a sense of how frightening things are and then the ability to lead, for most of us in the room, the same kind of lives that we were leading before, at the same time that many other people cannot lead the lives that they were leading before.
Anna, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that right now we're seeing a flood the zone by the Trump administration, and it makes it really hard to focus on one specific issue that might unite us. And we feel like because there are so many issues, he seems invincible. He's able to get his way in a lot of court rulings. He's attacking the press, and people are calling the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America now on Google Maps. We're seeing all these wins, and it's hard feeling so unempowered. And I would love to see us focus on one specific thing that really brings everybody together and get a significant win so that we can see that this isn't an unpenetratable force, something like Social Security, which Trump and Musk are calling a Ponzi scheme, and they're coming after our Poughkeepsie Social Security office and threatening to close it, which luckily it's off the DOGE list for now, but you know, it really makes you worry about these programs that we once thought were a third rail of politics and now seem kind of on the table. And so I hope that we as a society can unify around things that affect all of us, Social Security, free school meals for children. You know, there's so many issues, but picking one or two that we could really win on, I think, would be very interesting.
Elizabeth Lesser, the anxiety that many people feel, how do we find the center, not politically, but within ourselves, to be able to, and I like what you said, Francine, about that idea of toggling back and forth to what is happening in our world and our responsibilities as citizens and parents and spouses and partners. Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had the blessing and the curse to be a meditator and a spiritual seeker my whole life. And the blessing is that I do have tools that help me pause and cool my reactivity. But the curse is that I see things from everyone's point of view all the time. I agreed with so much of what you said, and I agreed with so much of what you said. And it often, I think this is a moment for so many of us, and maybe for many of you in the room, we don't know what to do, because doing anything, to me, when I look at the rage I feel and I want to go into the streets, I know that's just going to have so much backlash right now. I don't think it will help. We will know when it will help, but I don't think it is now. And I think a lot of us are feeling this, like, what do we do when a strong man, and I do believe he is a strong man. You know, I fear him as much as I fear Xi and Putin. What do we do when a strong man has come in and erased so many of our values? My last book was about women, and like you said, Francine, like, my fears in that book are like absurd compared to what's going on now. So I think it's critically important for all of us to calm our nervous systems, because actions that come from a sense of terror often have the exact opposite effect of what we want to see happen. So to me, one of my most precious spiritual practices right now is to have a historical perspective and to know that we have gotten through things like this before. This is not the first rodeo in America where people's rights were being trampled on. And I do have faith in our system. I do. And I think that is something to water. I think it's important to water the seeds of patience and faith. But I also think it's important to stay vigilant and aware. Unfortunately, I can't use a word right now that I consider my main practice these days. It's I saw it on a bumper sticker: do no harm, but take no. Starts with, it's S-H-I-T. I'll call it crap. Do no harm, but take no crap. This is something that I say to myself every morning when I wake up. Like, I'm going to have a very soft and open and loving and accepting heart. I'm going to try to do no harm today. But I am not going to take any crap. I'm going to have a very strong back. This is the posture of meditation. Strength and openness and softness at the same time. And I try to walk through the world that way. And that is how I calm my nervous system.
That was Elizabeth Lesser on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, March 26th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, March 27th, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. In the segment we'll share this morning, Malia Dumont addresses personal experience with confidential information communication in light of the Signal group chat leaks.
We didn't quite, we talked a little bit about the text leak, but because of the show yesterday, we were on other topics, although we did discuss it. So it's we want to really hit that today and talk more about it, because it seems to me that maybe there's just a lot there to talk about.
And that's what people have been doing ad nauseum for the last 48 hours.
But I don't
hours.
Know. I don't know how you don't, right? I mean, it's just it's an amazing story, in so many fronts, horrifying and amazing. And so we will talk about that. The other big story, of course, is about the tariffs, and we will certainly talk about that as well. So there was this leak. It was a. It's being called the Signal leak. It is the highest ranking security officials within our government were on an app that was encrypted but not as secure as normally would be the case. The argument that the administration is making that the information that was included was not classified. And those in the intelligence community and those who just seem to be normal people with a certain amount of common sense are saying, so you're talking about where and when the bombs are going to land. Does that not seem to be some level of classified information that would have been put onto this app? Add to it that at least two of the people were out of the country, one of them in Russia. So it is something that is, I think, more and more we're finding out more and more information. More information was released by the journalist who got included. He is being just ransacked by the administration as being the bad guy here. Meanwhile, all he did was basically answer his phone. So these are all the issues that are going through. I'm thrilled that Malia is here because she has great military experience as well as with classified and secure information. So where are you coming down on all this?
Well... thanks for asking. I need to precede my remarks by noting that I am a member of the Army Reserve. And so in the context of this program, I am sharing my personal opinion. I'm not representing the Army Reserve, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. So
are the same rules apply with chat with Pat?
They will. I don't think we're going to talk about leaks.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Just wanted to make sure that Pat wasn't getting an exclusive. Go ahead.
So for me, clearly it's an important question whether this information was classified. But I think the deeper question is whether this information endangered service member lives. Like, this is about safeguarding. I mean, what is the purpose of classifying information? It's supposed to keep sensitive information that potentially could be used against Americans if it falls into the wrong hands, to keep it protected. Now, there have been debates over the years whether the intelligence community is too big, whether things are overclassified, yada, yada, yada. But this information in this chat, which I have a printout in front of me, it involves actions that are going to be taken by individual service members. In this case, the pilots are going to fly the planes. And therefore, it's sensitive whether or not it's classified, secret, top secret. And then there are levels beyond top secret. It's still, it's incredible. What did you say before? Was it horrible and horrible and amazing?
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story.
Right.
But it's horrific as well.
Horrific and amazing, yes.
Yes.
So for example, I'll just...
Much like my prom.
So I have used, in several respects, I've used Signal in a military context with other service members. And I'll tell you what we've used it for, just so you can sort of, for your own comparative purposes, right? I have a Signal chat with a group of about, I think it's 20 other officers who were in the same unclassified training course together. And we use that Signal chat to talk about our homework assignments and, you know, who's going to be late to class, things like that. Because even for something that benign, I mean, our homework assignments were like, you know, reading about Clausewitz. It's nothing was classified. But it was considered, like, even those discussions, because they're taking place among U.S. military officers, that was considered too sensitive to put in just a regular text. So we would, and it's also it's not so convenient all the time to access your military email. You can't do that on your cell phone. So if you're just asking someone a quick question, like, what page is the assignment on? You know, you're going to use the Signal chat, and that's what we used it for. I used it when I was I spent 2 weeks in Korea doing a military exercise in the middle of COVID. That was very interesting. And those of us from my unit who were there used it again to coordinate, like, when's breakfast and who's on which shift, because that was considered, it wasn't classified because it wasn't. You know, we weren't doing actual operations. It was an exercise. But it was considered sensitive enough that we didn't want to put it on a regular text. So the fact that all this information, that names of specific people were used, that principals groups was referenced specifically. And for those who don't know, principals group is basically the cabinet without the president. And the principals group, also referred to as a principals committee, PC, which is also referenced in this, if you see that acronym in this chat, that's what it's referring to. And these people meet on a regular basis. That's what the National Security Council does. They convene PCs and deputies committees, who are usually the number two or their stand-in, to talk through. Like, every single day, these groups are meeting in the old executive office building next to the White House to discuss the key matters that are facing our country. I represented DOD on some lower level committees that were at that point called interagency policy committees. And Jim, are you having flashbacks, nostalgia?
I've been on some IAPs.
Yeah. And so, we would never even include the topic of what we would be discussing in an unclassified email. So I just, for those who have looked at it, I just want to briefly go through, just translate some of the language that's being used here in this text. So when Mike Waltz says, you received the guidance this morning in your high side inboxes, high side means top secret. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't say exactly what it is, but he's making reference to top secret material. I find it, he also says, joint staff will be sending you a more specific sequence of events. That is definitely, like, whatever the joint staff is sending is definitely the most highly classified information you could have. And I find it really incredible that nobody from the joint staff is included on this email list. And probably if they were, they would have been like, stop, because those people on the joint staff have been serving in the military for a long time. know how to handle classified information and would not allow this to continue.
So I want you to go through this and continue. I'm sorry for interrupting. Just a quick follow-up. Is there any chance – this seems to be the main mode of conversation between these individuals. We would not know, but it doesn't seem as if there are other conversations going on elsewhere, right, at the same time.
What do you mean, other conversations?
Meaning that these individuals would be communicating in another platform. Oh.
They weren't going
simultaneously
to
with this.
Like, see my email on the high side that
Correct.
Has more detail.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell, but it seems like, I mean, the people at this level wouldn't be engaging in super detailed. I mean, it's very surprising that the Secretary of Defense would share like this level of detail. It's not usually something that the SecDef would be communicating. Microphone's falling away.
Oh, okay.
There are guidelines in military in the country as to what is considered classified and what is not considered classified.
Oh yes, I mean there are lawyers who specialize in this. It's a highly calibrated, and it's designed to protect sources and methods. So that's one way that things are classified, at what level they're classified. But then even if you have, let's say, a top secret clearance, that doesn't mean you automatically get access to all top secret information. Your level of access is further restricted by what's called the need to know. And that's defined by – what was that?
And keywords,
yes. And that's defined by, you know, whatever missions you're working on, wherever you sit. And it's also there's a time stamp on that. It's not like you get access to top secret forever. And especially as your classification gets more specialized, it's more and more restricted. Like you have to keep updating it, or you have to keep getting a justification that is defined by the mission and the work that you do, that you need continued access to this work. And then there are entire technical systems, incredibly complex. Expansive technical systems that are built to protect this information and make sure that it's not hackable, and so this text kind of upends a lot of that, and just also for comparative purposes, you know, when I deployed to Afghanistan, I was not allowed to tell my own family, including my at that time husband, who was also in the Army, exactly when I was going. I mean, everyone knew I was going to Afghanistan, but I wasn't allowed to share for OPSEC, operational security reasons. I was not allowed to share that. And OPSEC, this is another thing. I'm sorry, I'm blowing past our break.
No, you're fine.
Okay. OPSEC
I saw where we're headed. We cleared the rails.
It's just when Heg says, you know, we're 100%, we're enforcing 100% OPSEC, that phrase Ridiculous. Doesn't really make sense to me.
Yes.
OPSEC is not, it's not like a, I mean, there are boxes you have to check, but it's an ongoing practice that is ingrained in you. If you have, even if you don't have a security clearance, OPSEC is not just about classified information. It's about anything that is potentially sensitive, including when I might be getting on a plane to go to Afghanistan. You know, my plane ticket is not classified, but it's sensitive information because people could anyone who might get access to, you know, my plane ticket and know that a couple other people are traveling or that my unit is traveling at the same time can extrapolate from that larger truths. And that's what we're trying to protect, because in the end, again, it comes back to service members' lives and American lives.
So what I am trying to figure out here is, and I think I'm certainly not alone in this, I think what we all are trying to perhaps figure out is of the information that was shared, of making the claim that this was not classified, then a further brain scratcher is that the only person who can classify it
This is according to the press secretary yesterday, Carolyn Leavitt. Who said yesterday that the only person who could that could classify it was the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, and that although she would not answer if he had declared it as classified, but that he would be the only person to classify it and unclassify it. First of all, is that true?
I don't believe so. No, I mean, as an intel officer, I haven't dealt with operational data very much. Like, my job has been about understanding who the adversary is, and so I personally have never seen anything like this before. On the intel side, it's not just the Secretary of Defense who classifies things. There are originating authorities, and the Secretary of Defense, I don't think, has blanket access to declassify things either.
Yeah.
The fact that the administration is focusing on this as a technical issue of whether it's classified or unclassified, that matters. But what really – I don't think – it's not possible to credibly dispute the idea that making the information about these operational plans available to a regular civilian – who didn't have a need to know, endangered American service member lives. It potentially endangered American service member lives. And there's no defense for that.
And part of another part of this, and then we'll take a break and then we'll come back. But another part of this is that, and I'm just trying to, again, figure all of this out, but it has been said that one of the reasons that Signal would have been used is that it goes away. It disappears after a certain period of time. So it's encrypted and then would not be the official means of communication, because then there would be a record that would go into the archives, which we would not have. We do not have in this particular case, had it not been for the reporter that happened to be included in the chat from The Atlantic.
Yeah, I mean, that's possibly true. I'll just point back again to my time in government. I'm sure Jim has a similar experience. There are a number of reasons that we minimized the phone calls we had, even on unclassified subjects. It's because we were very aware at all times that part of our job was maintaining a record for the American people, and that this needed to be preserved through written correspondence. And so we put a lot of things into email on the correct channels, whether it's secret or top secret, whatever. It was very important to keep that written record. And so that's part of that's actually been one of the hardest things for me. I've been in the civilian world for 10 years now, and I still sort of default to writing an email first, because I have that idea like we want to keep this, even though there's one of the nice things about the civilian world is you get to talk to people face to face more and like build these relationships that can be really meaningful, and I feel like I get work done in a different way that's really helpful, but that clearly isn't going to happen here with this text. It is now. I wonder who Mike Waltz thought he was adding.
That was Malia Dumont on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, March 27th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, March 28th, Joe was joined by CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti, Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College, and since 2023, she has been President of the World Affairs Council of Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Rydell, and economist working as Associate Professor of Economics at Bard College, President of the Levy Economics Institute, and expert at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Pavlina Chernova.
President Trump and his supporters have clashed with mainstream economists for years about the merits of tariffs. Now the world will get to see who is right as the president's sweeping levies on automobiles and auto parts play out in real time. Experiment on the global economy. And Mr. Trump's telling tariffs have a straightforward effect. They encourage companies to move factories to the United States, creating more American jobs and prosperity. But for many economists, the effect of tariffs is anything but simple. The tariffs are likely to encourage domestic car production over the long run, they say, but they will also cause substantial collateral damage that could backfire on the president's goals for jobs, manufacturing, and the economy at large. Aaron.
So this, you know, the tariffs are part of Trump's playbook because they're easily digested by the population. They're easy headlines. There's something he can do without actually passing legislation. The problem is that they are not only ineffective at bringing back domestic jobs that have been offshored, is that they're actually going to be counterproductive and create, if they continue, very likely rising inflation, higher unemployment. So all of a sudden, for the first time since the 1970s, you're hearing economists talk about the real possibility of stagflation, which is a combination of stagnation, meaning low growth and high unemployment, and inflation. But I think a bigger point here, and the vein that Trump has tapped, is that the problems that he's claiming to address are very real. The loss of manufacturing jobs, wage stagnation, rising inequality, declining economic mobility, those are real issues. Tariffs aren't going to fix those. But what he's responding to is something that has been brewing for, you know, four decades. The jobs that have been offshored aren't coming back, right? We're not, like Howard Lutnick was talking about, bringing sneaker manufacturing back to the U.S. Well, that's probably not going to happen. So thinking about some forward-looking type of economic policy that would actually create jobs either directly or indirectly, I think, is more important. But you're starting to see the cracks in this approach. Consumer confidence, the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey was released yesterday. Consumer confidence is the lowest it has been since January 21st. Everybody put your brain into where you were on January 2021. You know, peak COVID, there was no vaccines. It was still a very scary time. So consumer sentiment has already started to plunge because people just see this uncertainty and are concerned about what's happening. You're starting to see business confidence measures go down. You're starting to see an inflection in business investment. The issue here is that putting tariffs on imported cars isn't just going to make people switch to domestic cars, because the tariffs are also imposed on car parts. So 60% of a car made by an American company are imported. So you've got Japanese electronics, you've got, you know, German circuitry, all of these things. And, you know, those cars are produced in, part of it's produced in Canada, then it's shipped to Mexico, then it comes back to the U.S. So the idea that you're buying a domestic-made car is just not true. These cars are very globally integrated in terms of sourcing raw materials. So it's really unclear what he's trying to accomplish besides looking tough. I think he claims that putting tariffs in place is a way to gain leverage and to use as a bargaining chip with other countries. But in the process, he's creating collateral damage. The uncertainty that he is creating because of this is going to have very real effects on the economy, whether the tariffs remain in place or not. So to me, this is counterproductive. I think, in my own opinion, he wants car company executives, foreign politicians to come to Washington and the White House, kneel down, kiss his ring, and make him feel good about himself. And then he'll remove the tariffs and everybody looks like a winner. But there's going to be a lot of collateral damage in the process.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. They are very much a tool for negotiation. Their intended effects on the economy are going to be largely negative, although even the magnitude of it is not quite clear, because if you remember last time around, he used tariffs again as a leverage. You know, he threatened tariffs, then he will pull out tariffs or threaten them again, pull them out. So we don't know exactly where this thing is going to fall, but this is in his broad executive powers, so he can really antagonize other countries and potentially increase tariffs far more than he's threatening at the moment. You know, at Levy we did this, and we are right now looking at kind of the relationship between tariffs and jobs, etc., and the state of the manufacturing industry. And I think the greatest damage that was done to manufacturing is indeed after NAFTA. And I think this is the legitimate grievance that people are feeling and that is generating some sympathies for his policies. And it really was a fundamental restructuring and reshifting of the manufacturing sector, of production, of supply chains, how we do things. And, of course, that costs a lot of jobs. But I want to talk a little bit about jobs because this sector is a sector that's being automated. This right. is not a very labor-intensive sector. And if you look at the share of manufacturing in the total economy, it's very small. And the share of employment, in particular, the share of employment in the transportation manufacturing is something like 2% of total employment. So like 3 million jobs or something like that. So let's double the amount of manufacturing jobs. It will do something for some communities, no doubt. I very much doubt that this will do it because a tariff is a tax. A tariff is going to, you know, we've already seen, you know, price increases of cars because of supply chain disruptions during COVID. Slap a tariff on top of that, you're not going to see some robust demand for automobiles because we have tariffs. You know, as Aaron said, prices will go up, no doubt. So that's number one. But if the grievance is jobs, we need to be thinking in entirely different ways how to fix jobs, because what NAFTA did is actually weaken wages, weaken labor protections, weaken the quality of employment and the kinds of jobs that we had. And I'm not hearing this in the conversation. All I'm hearing is, let's just bring, you know, factories here. But we're not talking about stronger unions, better wages. If anything, this administration is not too sympathetic to unions. I mean, selectively, you know, is supporting some unions, but it is definitely, just today they announced that they wanted to get rid of federal unions for federal employees. So, you know, I think that if Trump is billing himself as the president who will bring back jobs, I think this is not going to happen through tariffs.
Well, I run the State Manufacturing Association, and we have manufacturers in the state that actually make component parts. And just a few things that are notable. The parts sometimes cross the border four or five times. My understanding initially, not on in this round, but my understanding initially of the tariffs was it's every border crossing. So that creates a cost issue that really makes you scratch your head. But the other thing is, universally, the manufacturers in New York and I would say across the country, and I talk to state chambers and manufacturing associations all the time, one of their biggest problems is they can't find enough workforce. We have a huge workforce shortage in manufacturing, to the point where I've, you know, spoken to manufacturers who are concerned that they can't run a full line. And it's very costly to shut down manufacturing and restart. So you want to be running your line around the clock. And they are having challenges doing that because they don't have enough people right now. So if you – now, automation is a partial solution to that. And I am a very strong advocate for automation. And if anyone is really, really bored and wants to be depressed, go read the New Yorker article about the end of childhood, because it talks about the demographic cliff that we're on. We're going to have way worse workforce issues moving forward. We don't have enough people. We need to either automate or get a lot more people. Hopefully AI and automation will solve part of this. So there's a whole bunch of things that it seems counterproductive to me to try and bring not that it's not good to have manufacturing domestically, but in a global economy to say it all has to be done here, who's gonna run it? It's a big question mark.
And of course, adding on to that, the obvious fact that we're not acting in a vacuum, it'll lead to a trade war. My father is a proud driver, lifelong driver of Ford cars because they're good in Germany. They're good and they're cheaper than the BMW or Mercedes. But there will be tariffs, of course, put on the Fords coming into Europe, and that will make the Ford more expensive.
There is a massive Ford manufacturing facility in China in Chongqing, I think. 35,000 people, at least in 2017 when I was there, the number was 35,000 people work in this Ford manufacturing facility in China, which, you know, I don't know how the tariffs work if you're manufacturing in China. Is China going to put a tariff on the U.S. brand? I don't think so, but I don't know.
But can I ask the economists here, because my concern as a political scientist is always like, what is it going to do to the relationship between the countries with our allies? And obviously it goes without saying it's the relationship has been damaged. This is a trade deal that was made under the first Trump administration. It worked. Now it's a Trump administration that is dismantling the trade deal that worked. Do you think the relationship with our allies, based on the economic perspective, can we rebuild it? Will it be rebuilt?
Think there has been permanent damage. Just today, I think Mark Carney announced our trade relationship with the United States is dead, essentially.
I think he didn't say trade relationship. I think he said relationship.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
maybe overall. But yes, I think that we are definitely entering a new era in global trade relationships. And it's not quite clear how we'll emerge out of this. We are so dependent and integrated. We've become so interdependent over the last few decades. So I think that, you know, there will be enormous disruptions. And it would be important to see what's on the other side. What is the benefit from these disruptions? And I don't see them as an economist. I don't see them in the form of jobs. I don't see them in the form of better pay. We do hold manufacturing as a model of good jobs, right? And that should be our model to change other industries. You know, the service sector employs 80% of all people, right? Like, if we continue to, you know, elevate manufacturing jobs as this kind of dream job that gives us good communities, that, you know, supports families, then we need to be thinking about how to do this for other industries. But I'm not seeing this. You know, if we're having shortage in employment, there are ways to address these shortages. We can have vocational training. We can have on-the-job training. We can have apprenticeship programs. There are things, but those require action. Those require thought. They require actually planning by the government. And it seems that we're doing precisely the opposite in terms of destroying public capacities to embark on any of these investments.
That was Pavlina Chernova on the Roundtable panel on Friday, March 28th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.